Hi, everybody. My name is Jim Wolverton, and I am the Director of Legal Content here at Krauss Financial. And I am truly, truly excited to be joined today by Mark Munson. He's a good friend of mine. We have taught many, many courses together, put many courses together. And today, I reached out to Mark a few months ago and I said, Mark, what's on your mind? What's hot in elder law right now? And he told me that retirement accounts and retirement assets. And how they integrate and work with Medicaid crisis planning is what him and his clients are talking a lot about. And even as we've put together this program, we've hosted a few national courses over the last few months, and retirement accounts, retirement assets keep coming up. So I think we have a very timely topic. I couldn't have anyone better to speak on these issues here than Mark Munson, and I'll do a little introduction for him momentarily. But for those of you that are not aware of what Krauss Financial is, we are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. And we use specialized insurance products, resources, and support to help attorneys streamline the process of advising their clients planning for long-term care. And we're going to actually talk about a lot about what all that means. But you can see there some stats there. We have over 30 years of experience. Dale Krauss, the founder of our firm, was on the front end of some of these Medicaid compliant annuity solutions. 40 plus professionals on staff. This is a growing industry. So those of you that have not fully embraced elder law as a practice area, it is growing, and that's because of the population of seniors is growing. And we actually just started a new employee yesterday, so we're really excited to have her on board. And then we handle in-house about 400 plus Medicaid compliant annuity cases monthly. So if you do have a client that needs crisis planning, we've probably seen the situation, and our planners can help you and your clients kind of overcome those hurdles and get your clients qualified for Medicaid as quickly as possible. So that's a little bit about Krauss Financial. Sorry, I lost my cursor again. A little bit about Mark. Mark is, I'm just going to wing this, Mark. I hope you don't mind. Mark is an attorney, first and foremost. He's also a CELA, which means he's a certified elder law attorney, which is a very difficult test to pass. When you talk to elder law attorneys, they talk about how difficult that test is to pass. But more importantly, Mark has been doing elder law for a very long time, and he's also been very involved locally and nationally with elder law attorneys. Me and Mark kind of developed a friendship by going to national conferences, traveling around the country, and Mark would speak. I would usually be at the booth representing the company, and Mark and I would strike up very unique conversations at the bar, sometimes about some of the issues we're going to talk about today. What do you do with this particular asset? I had an attorney ask me about this, Mark. What would you think? And so Mark always had a very thoughtful solution and a solution that always was easy to understand. A lot of times when you talk to attorneys that have been doing this for a very long time, this practice area, they'll say stuff and it's completely over your head and you have no idea what they're talking about. But Mark has a very skilled way of teaching folks. I remember we were in Denver, Mark, and you were teaching one of my other coworkers Medicaid planning, and she had sat through limitless hours of Medicaid presentations, and she started repeating some of the things you were teaching her. So if you can teach, you can teach folks that have turned off their ears to listen to these things. I'm sure you'll do a great job with attorneys that are interested in learning. And besides that, Mark's a good friend, and I'm really happy to have him here. So Mark, with that, I'll kind of hand it off to you to take over the presentation here today.
All right, great. Thanks, Jim, and welcome everyone. This is again, Jim, this is kind of a brainchild for Jim and me. And whether we like it or not, retirement benefits moving forward are going to be the largest assets that clients are likely to have. The time and era of pensions, which is you work and you get a monthly payment that replaces your monthly earnings or your monthly wages, so that you can retire and you still have monthly income. Pensions have kind of gone away and they've been replaced by contribution plans. And contribution plans are plans that an employee and an employer contributes to, and it's more asset-based than it is income-based. And with that shift in retirement plans, our assets are our clients are going to be coming to us with these assets. And in many cases, these assets are going to be larger than their real estate asset, which is their home. So you might have a client with a $200,000 home, but a $300,000 retirement account, or a $400,000 home and an $800,000 retirement account. So more often than not, we're going to see moving forward that these types of accounts are going to be the largest assets that our clients have. And with retirement benefits, there are a whole host of special rules that go with these special assets. And so what we wanted to do today was to kind of break down a little bit and start going over some of these special rules with these special assets so that we can become familiar with the assets that our clients are going to have. And if we're familiar with these types of assets, then we can start working with them. So there are, one type of retirement account is the IRA. Simply enough, it stands for Individual Retirement Account. We'll get to this later. Be mindful that IRA could also mean individual retirement annuity. But for now, let's mainly go with individual retirement account. And so there are two types of IRAs out there. One is the traditional IRA, the other is the Roth IRA. They are both special accounts. That's kind of the best way to think about any retirement account, is that it's a special account. It has special rules. It is going to be different from any other type of account you have out there. And we'll kind of get into that as well. But so the idea with a traditional IRA is money that goes into that account is generally after-tax money, but you get a deduction for it when you contribute. So now it becomes pre-tax money, which is kind of weird. And then it grows income tax free. And then when you take it out, then it's going to be income for income tax purposes. That's the way to think about an IRA, is that if you contribute to a traditional IRA, your chances are you're going to contribute to that with after-tax money, money that's already been subject to income tax, but you get a deduction for the contribution. Now, there are income limits and income rules, and I'm not going to get into all that. But that's the idea, is you transform after-tax money into pre-tax money. And once it's pre-tax, then it's going to grow income tax free. But when you take it out, then that'll be income for income tax purposes. The Roth IRA, similar in concept, you're going to contribute on an after-tax basis. This is money that's already been subject to income tax once, probably after you earned it in the form of self-employment or wages. And you contribute to the Roth account. Again, there are income limits. You can't make $5 million and contribute directly to a Roth account. But if you are able to contribute to a Roth account, it's with after-tax dollars. There is no deduction for that contribution, so you don't you don't get to deduct that against your current income taxes. Once again, it grows income tax free. But the big difference with a Roth account is that when you take the money out, as long as you follow certain Roth IRA account rules, when you take that money out, it is not income for income tax purposes. So with a traditional IRA, you have to take money out at a certain age. This year, that age is 73. Before then, you don't have to take it out if you don't want to. If you reach 73, there's a minimum amount that you have to take out. With a Roth IRA, there is no minimum that you have to take out at any age during your lifetime. And we've put the code sections on there that govern these types of accounts. So most of us are familiar with 401k retirement plans. Obviously, it's named after the code section in code section 401 and then subpart K. That's where these plans come from. We now have a Roth retirement, a Roth 401k plan, which is permitted by section 402 capital A of the code. And so 401k plans are really for private employers. And again, they're contribution based plans. They are plans that employers set up to allow for contributions by employees and to allow for contributions by employers. 403b plans are the public sector employment equivalent of 401k plans. So you'll see hospitals, you'll see schools set up and have 403b plans for their employees. And again, they're contribution-based plans where employees and employers can contribute to these plans. There's also a Roth 403b plan that's available. Again, that's allowed by 402 capital A. So the biggest thing about these plans, IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, even Roth IRAs, Roth 401k, Roth 403b, the biggest thing about these accounts is that, just think of that they are special accounts, and there are special accounts because of the income tax laws that surround them. All of these code sections that we just provided you, 401, 402 capital A, 403, 408, and 408A, all of these are code sections for the Internal Revenue Code. So all of these are federal laws, but they're all in the Internal Revenue Code, which is code for tax. So there are special tax rules regarding these types of accounts, because the design behind these laws is to promote retirement. So you get special rules, you get special tax rules, because we're trying to promote retirement and have people put money away so they have money when they retire. So if it's a non-Roth retirement account, what is the income tax treatment? Well, we talked about that. If you think about your 401k, your 401k is a little different than the traditional IRA. It goes right from your wages to the 401k, and it never gets subject to income tax. So you don't have to do the dance of it's subject to income tax, put it in the IRA, and then get a deduction. You don't get a deduction when you contribute to a 401k on your income tax return, but it's also not going to show up as income for purposes of income tax on your W-2. So in that sense, you kind of get a deduction. It's just you don't really take it on a tax return when you go right into your 401k. But the primary gist here is that what goes into a non-Roth retirement account is pre-tax dollars, money that's never been subject to income tax before. So that's the gist with these accounts. What helps is that the earnings, the growth on this, whether it's interest, whether it's dividends, whether it's appreciation, whatever it is, the earnings and the growth is not subject to income tax as long as it is in the account. So it's essentially this money is working for you on an income tax-free basis while it's working. But when you reach retirement and when you want to access money from your non-Roth retirement account, when you pull it out of your non-Roth retirement account, when you take a withdrawal, that is going to be income for income tax purposes. So at some point, the government is going to get, tax this wealth. It is not on contribution, but it is on withdrawal. And so at some point, the government is going to subject this money in this account where it is going to have to be recognized as income for income tax purposes. So for non-Roth retirement accounts, pre-income tax money goes in, income comes out. So for Roth retirement accounts, it's almost the opposite. After tax money goes in, so it's going to have been subject to income tax. So after tax money goes in, while it's in the Roth-based retirement account, you still have the same treatment that it's growing and working income tax-free. So interest, dividends, appreciation, anything that happens inside of that account is not being subject to taxation. So if you bought Apple computer stock for $1,000 in your Roth account and you sell it for $100,000 inside the Roth account, that's not going to be gain that's subject to income taxes because the asset and the money is still inside the Roth account. And that's the same thing for a traditional non-Roth retirement account. Any realization event where you have a gain, that's not subject to tax as long as it stays inside the retirement account. Doesn't matter whether it's non-Roth or Roth, anything, if it happens inside the retirement account, it's not subject to tax. So what happens when money comes out of the Roth account? When money comes out of the Roth account, it is not income for income tax purposes. And that's the big value of Roth accounts, Roth-based accounts, is that when you take that money out to use it in your retirement, it is not income for income tax purposes. So what about, we touched on this a little bit, but what are the special rules for these special assets when we have to take it out? Well, for traditional IRAs, for regular non-Roth 401ks and for non-Roth 403bs, we have these rules in place where you have to start taking the money out at a certain age. That's the law. You have to start taking out a minimum amount, and that's called the minimum required distribution or the required minimum distribution. I don't care if you want to call it an MRD or an RMD, it's the same concept, it's the same thing. Money has to come out. this year, 2024, if you reach, well, this is where this stuff gets a little tricky. So here's how it works. You have to start taking money out on April 1st of the year after you reach age 73. That's just the best way to think about it. So if you reached age 73 last year, you have to take your first required minimum distribution by April 1st of this year. If you haven't done it, you're late, and that's not good. If you're turning 73 this year, you have to take money out this year, or you can defer it all the way till next year, April 1st. But that would mean next year you're going to have two required minimum distributions, one for 2024 and one for 2025. Because your 2025 distribution will have to be taken by December 31st of 2025. So the point being, if it's a non-Roth account, you have to start taking money out. And there are minimum required distribution laws and rules regarding this. You have to take the money out. Upon death, that's a whole separate CLE about how all this works after death and how money comes out. But there are obviously, there are definitely rules regarding it, because if you think about what's going on here, this is all pre-tax money that's continuing to grow income tax free as long as it's inside of the IRA or 401k or 403b account, and the government doesn't want that to go on forever. So there are rules when you pass about how rapidly the money has to come out and be subject to income taxation. So for Roth accounts, you know, this gets to be a little bit tricky, because there's a difference between a Roth IRA and a non-Roth IRA. That sound is the we have a tornado alarm that goes off. So that's all that was. It's the weekly warning.
Okay.
For
you don't need a seek shelter.
No.
Okay.
So usually they do that at 1:15 Central. So I don't know what happened there. Maybe they're testing it. So anyway, getting back to Roth distribution requirements. Again, you never have to take money out. There's no required minimum distributions. That's helpful. So if you don't need or want this money in your retirement, you can keep it in the Roth account and it can keep growing and keep working on an income tax-free basis. So that is a huge, huge advantage for Roth IRAs. But if you have a Roth 401k or a Roth 403b, then you do have to take money out, just like as if it's a traditional IRA, 401k, or 403b. So what do? Roll your Roth 401k over into a Roth IRA, and now you don't have to, you can avoid required minimum distributions. So those are the rules. You know, say Jim and I don't write them. That's what they say. So that's what we got to do. At death, the rules are very, very similar to traditional pre-income tax retirement accounts, because it's the what the government wants to avoid for Roth accounts is having these things continue to grow on an income tax-free basis. Eventually, they want the money out of the Roth retirement account. They want it out so that, you know, when it comes out, it's still going to come out income tax-free, but the dividends, the interest, the capital gains, the earnings, the growth, that's all going to be subject to tax every single year. They So, the goal of the law with these things is to, at some point, we have to start paying taxes every single year on this money. Because while money is inside a retirement account, any retirement account, Roth or non-Roth, it is growing and it is working on an income tax-free basis. That's the special rule. So it's designed to allow growth to occur while you're working so that you have it available in retirement. So what kind of assets can you have within a retirement account? And does it matter really between if it's a Roth retirement account or a non-Roth retirement account? And the answer is really no. That doesn't matter. So if you want to have a traditional IRA with a bank or credit union so that you can have a savings account and earn interest or have CDs and earn interest, you can do that. You can do that with a Roth IRA. And that's no problem. Can you have a brokerage account or an investment account inside of a traditional IRA? No problem. And that's what most financial advisors, whether it's, Edward Jones, whether it's Schwab, whether it's Fidelity or Vanguard, I mean, Merrill Lynch, whoever it is, most of these accounts, most of these IRAs are in, with investment or brokerage firms so that this money can be invested and working for you more than just interest. Now, interest is catching up. We have higher interest rates right now, but there was the last 15 years, interest rates were very, very, very low. And you can have retirement accounts in bank or credit union products, savings or CDs, just you weren't earning very much. Now you can earn more with interest rates, but you can have retirement accounts, Roth or non-Roth, with an investment or brokerage or firm. And that's probably what you're going to see most often when you're working with clients. And then annuities can also be purchased inside of a retirement account, Roth and non-Roth. And this is where you kind of think about it as, that acronym of IRA, individual retirement account. It could also mean individual retirement annuity. If we focus in on annuities, and we will get there, and that's really mainly what we're talking about here. If we focus on annuities, annuities are products from insurance companies. That's who issues annuities. And the reason for that is because annuities are contracts that carry with them certain guarantees. And you're not going to see Ed Jones or Fidelity or Schwab say, hey, we're going to provide you with guarantees. That's not what they do. They allow you to invest in the market. The market goes up and down, and there are no guarantees. They say that quite explicitly. Past performance is not an indicator of future performance, and there's no guarantees. With annuities, if you really get into the entire contract, it's really full of guarantees. Sometimes the guarantees can be exceeded, but there are guaranteed minimums. That's why people purchase annuities. Well, it's really insurance companies, mainly life insurance companies, who underwrite and put out for purchase annuities. It's really an insurance-based product, and you can own that inside of a retirement account, a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA, individual retirement annuity. Where you're not going to see annuities is in 401k plans, 403B plans or those types of plans. Most employers are not going to offer them. And so that's why you don't see 401k annuity or 403B annuity, even though 403B, the whole plan is called a tax sheltered annuity. It's really quite bizarre. But where you see most annuities with your clients is going to be in IRAs, traditional IRAs or Roth IRAs. And if you see that, then that IRA, okay, it still is an individual retirement account, but it's also, you should think of it as an individual retirement annuity. And then, you know, also coming into vogue, you're going to see this are self-directed retirement accounts, because somebody's going to say, I've got $1 million in my retirement account, and I think buying a $500,000 rental complex is going to be a good bet for my retirement. So can you use $500,000 from a client's IRA so the IRA becomes the owner of the apartment complex, and then all the rent, that's income, that's like dividends or interest, all the rent comes into the retirement account, and then that can go to the client for retirement income. If the rental complex goes from 500,000 to a million, and the IRA, self-directed IRA, sells that, there's no capital gains on that because it stayed inside the IRA. So we're going to see more and more of self-directed IRAs as more and more money come into these things, and people want to diversify their assets within their retirement accounts. So Medicaid rules and retirement accounts. Jim, do you want to take this one or do you want me to?
No, sure. I'll review this really quick. This is just real basic Medicaid knowledge. And if you need more of this, we have this all over Attorney Access if this is new to you. But we'll just do this at a super high level. Is that when somebody applies to receive Medicaid benefits, they have to comply with certain resource rules. And generally in most states, an individual is allowed to keep $2,000 of countable assets in most states. Now that can generally go up from there. And California is the most recent. So if anybody on this is from California, they just changed their rules the beginning of 2024. And said, we don't care about assets. There's no asset limit anymore in California. Connecticut, unfortunately, was one of the states that had a resource limit in place in 1972 when Medicaid was created, and their asset limit was $1,600. They haven't brought it up in all those many, many years. And so theirs is still $1,600. And you can see that some other states have increased above 2,000. But when usually we're talking about these things, we usually say, the institutionalized individual can generally keep $2,000 or close thereto outside of Illinois and New York. They have higher individual resource amounts. If there's a community spouse, the community spouse is allowed to keep what's called the community spouse resource allowance, and that's a different amount, and it generally is an amount that falls somewhere between $30,000 and about $150,000 in that range somewhere. And so If the family has resources above that, the couple has resources above that, they have to figure out what to do with it. And that's what we refer to as crisis planning. And that's really what Kraus Financial Resources has made a name for itself across the years. And so what are we going to do with those resources if they're above those individual or the community spouse resource allowance? Now, like Mark said, as the future becomes reality, a lot more of these retirement accounts are going to come into play. But one thing that you have to know for your state Medicaid rules is whether or not these retirement accounts are considered a countable resource. So the way that I always teach this is think of your state's Medicaid rules. The federal Medicaid rules say retirement accounts can be countable resources. States, you can choose if you want to exempt them or not. So start with that baseline. is accounts of both the individual and the community spouse, if they have one, are countable resources. However, states do have the latitude to exempt them. So some states, if you look at this map, the orange states show that accounts of both spouses are countable resources. So, okay, we have, like Mark's example, $800,000 in a retirement account. Number one, we have to figure out who owns that retirement account. Is that in the institutionalized individual or the community spouse? In those orange states, it doesn't matter. All those retirement assets are going to be countable resources. We have to figure out what to do with them. In the gray states, the accounts of the community spouse are exempt. And that is mainly based in the idea that we don't want to impoverish community spouses. Just because the institutionalized spouse is living in a nursing home doesn't mean the community spouse doesn't have bills they have to pay and they need a way to do that. So in those gray states, the accounts of the community spouse are exempt. So if the community spouse owns a retirement account, non-countable, we just have to worry about the institutionalized spouse. And then in those states that are shaded in black, accounts of both spouses are exempt. And so those are states where you don't have to worry about these retirement accounts as being a countable resource for Medicaid planning purposes. They're just exempt accounts. So with that in place, Mark, do you want to come back and kind of talk about how these different types of annuities that you might run into that are within these retirement accounts are treated and what you can do as far as the planning side goes, now that we know we're assuming they're accountable resources, they're non-countable, we don't have to worry about them. But if they are accountable resource, what do you have to do with them? And what are your options really?
Sounds good. So again, I'll remind everybody, annuities are financial products offered by insurance companies. And so there are two main types that we're going to talk about. One is known as a deferred annuity, where it really is more of an asset, and it just think of it more of as an asset, and it's an asset that's there. The biggest, you know, where you're going to really see deferred annuities is if you purchase a deferred annuity. There's some tax rules that go with deferred annuities that are not inside these retirement accounts, and I don't want to spend too much time talking about that, but you know where you see this is, you know, if you purchase an annuity and the growth that occurs is exempt from income taxation. That's the big draw to annuities. If you purchase an annuity and you don't touch that money is growing for your client on an income tax-free basis. And so, but for Medicaid, that deferred annuity, which is something they can access anytime they want to, is an available asset. It's like their checking account, it's like their savings account, it's an available asset. And that's the best way to think about deferred annuities. Jim has put down some language from the Wisconsin Medicaid manual, which I'm fortunately overly familiar with. But what it's saying is that, hey, that's an asset. That's an available asset. And so think of it just like a checking account. Think of it like a savings account. That's the best way to think about deferred annuities. Now, if you've got a deferred annuity inside of a retirement account, traditional IRA or Roth IRA, it's really the same analysis of whether it's available or not. And you just have to check your state's rules and go back to Jim's chart here. And, you know, if it's a deferred annuity and it's inside an IRA, it's either going to be counted or it's going to be exempt. Find out what your state says, and that's where we go. So immediate annuities, what immediate annuities are annuities that have been annuitized. And so that you're not able, if you're the owner, you can't just go to the annuity company and say, hey, Give me 5,000, or give me 10,000, or give me 15,000. That option is gone because the contract has been annuitized. Again, it's kind of a contractual concept. If it's been annuitized, that's kind of an irrevocable election, and it's going to pay out to you a monthly amount. That's what an immediate annuity is. You purchase the contract, and instead of it being an asset that you can access as much of or a little of as you want, you can't access any of it, but the annuity company is going to pay you monthly income every single month. So every annuity, even a deferred annuity, can be annuitized, in which case it then becomes an immediate annuity. Some annuities are immediate annuities upon purchase because that's what you want, and that's really what Crouse Financial Services does. So any annuity can be an immediate annuity. It's some of them are purchased on the premise of not being annuitized right away, or not being immediate right away. Immediate just means we're annuitizing it. And so here's the problem with immediate annuities in Medicaid. And again, I don't write these rules. And if you practice in Medicaid and elder law long enough, you get to the realization that logic, common sense doesn't matter. It really, really doesn't matter. Here's the problem with immediate annuities, or taking a deferred annuity and making it in an immediate annuity. Again, or annuitizing in an annuity. Here's the problem. You have to be mindful of the Medicaid rules and how they work. This is why we're doing this, because all at the same time, again, no logic and no common sense, an immediate annuity at one time can be considered to be an available asset. It can be considered to be monthly income, and it can be considered to be a gift, all at one time, which is an insane concept. You know, how can you have an asset that is also considered to have been gifted? No, it makes no logical and no common sense, and that's Medicaid law for you. But that is the law. I don't think the law has to have logic or common sense. It just, we have to do what the law says. And what the law says is that in any immediate annuity, any annuitized annuity needs to be looked at from the standpoint of available asset, monthly income for your client, and gifting or transfer for less than fair market value.
And I included some of the sample language from the Wisconsin Medicaid manual, so that you can see when you look in your Medicaid manual, what kind of language are you looking for? As someone who bounces around through different states' Medicaid manuals, unfortunately, I've come to find out that a lot of the language tends to be pretty similar. So I wanted to make sure that when you're looking at how to analyze the immediate annuity, what to look for. And so you're looking for these terms, irrevocable annuity, and there's not a lot of guidance here. May or may not be considered an available countable asset, depending on when it was purchased and whether it can be sold in the secondary market. So you have to look at each one specifically, but at least it gives you a place to start. So I know there's lots of other relevant information on annuities. Are there a couple of these you want to pull out specifically, Mark?
I would just say for everyone attending, if you have a client who has an annuity, it's probably good to get this information, and you'll know whether it's annuitized or not. But this is good information to get for every single annuity that a client may have, because that allows you to be a better advisor.
And I know, Mark, you have this on intake sheets. This is the information you have when you're asking your clients about their annuities, correct?
Right. They can't fill this out, but I give them a sheet to take with them so they can contact the annuity company or contact a life insurance agent, whoever it is that they can work with to obtain this information.
Excellent. Okay, let's talk about that availability issue.
So again, annuities, a deferred annuity, very, 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 very simple. It's an available asset. And you have to think of a deferred annuity just like a checking account. It's an available asset, and you're going to have to deal with it in order for your client to obtain Medicaid eligibility. So deferred annuities are incredibly, incredibly easy. Just it's like a checking account. Immediate annuities or annuitized annuities, these things are different, and you got to look at them from what I just said before. You have to look at them from an asset availability standpoint. You have to look at it from a monthly income standpoint, and you need to look at it from a gifting standpoint. So annuitized annuities are different. If you don't want an annuitized annuity to where you have to look at it from an asset standpoint or a gifting standpoint, this is where Kraus Financial Services comes in. But if you've got an annuity from XYZ annuity company and it's annuitized, you need to look at it from all three levels of, is this an available asset? Is it income, which it will be? And is it a gift within the last 5 years?
Yeah, and Mark, I can cover this stuff really quick. And what Mark's talking about is gifts in the Medicaid context. And again, this is kind of some basic Medicaid concepts that I'll go over pretty quickly. And if you do have questions about this, we have lots and lots of resources across Attorney Access. And I actually just did a COLE last week on this, and we have one coming up as well. So the look back period is basically transfers that are made within the last 5 years. And if there have been transfers for less than fair market value during that look back period, the applicant for Medicaid would be subject to a period of Medicaid ineligibility. And that's based on the value of that gift. And so what you do is you take your state's penalty divisor, you divide it by the value of the gift, and that gives you how many months the person is ineligible for Medicaid benefits. So let's say our example here at the bottom, we have Bob made $50,000 worth of gifts in the last 5 years. Penalty divisor in his state's $5,000. We take the $50,000 worth of gifts, divide it by 5,000. Bob's ineligible for Medicaid benefits for 10 months. So really what we're talking about in this situation, if Bob had an annuity and he gave that away, he would be subject to, just gave it away to his kids, he'd be subject to a penalty period because that would be a gift. However, there are...
Let's go back to that slide, though, Jim. I want, Jim and I always, what we try to do every presentation we do are, hey, you should take out your pen and maybe take down some notes. This is one of those times. And if you go to, if you follow Jim's example below, deferred annuity and you gave it away. Also, I would also say, if you have a deferred annuity, and you make the election to make it an immediate annuity and you annuitize it, that now needs to be evaluated against these look back and penalty period rules. And so be mindful of that. That's something that it doesn't seem like you're making a gift if you have a deferred annuity and you're just annuitizing it, so it's a payment to yourself. I agree. There's no logic. There's no common sense in Medicaid law. And if a client in the last 5 years has annuitized a deferred annuity to make it immediate, you need to look at it for these look back and penalty period things.
Excellent. So there are transfers that you can make that are non-penalized, and that's where the Medicaid compliant annuity comes in. And we'll talk a little bit about that on the next slides. Was there anything else? I know you wanted to highlight these particular subsections, Mark.
Yeah, no, I just people should look at them and become familiar with them.
And again, we have an endless amount of information on Medicaid compliant annuities, but the key to these, and this is written in those federal statutes, is a Medicaid compliant annuity has to be irrevocable, non-assignable, actuarially sound, which means it has to pay out equal payments pursuant to the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. And in most states, that's the Social Security life expectancy tables. Other states have their own. Those payments have to be made in equal payments. And depending on whether or not there is a spouse or minor disabled child, the state has to be listed as a beneficiary, either as in a primary position or in a secondary position. So in order to transfer without a penalty, an annuity that would be a countable resource into a non-countable Medicaid compliant annuity that's going to start paying income out in equal payments, which is you would only use these Medicaid compliant annuities for that purpose to take a countable retirement asset and convert it into a non-countable Medicaid compliant annuity to start paying income. Then we've taken that asset off the board for Medicaid qualification purposes, and we've made that retirement account, if it can be converted into a Medicaid compliant annuity, a non-countable resource. Mark, do you kind of want to go over the concept here, or do you want me to continue?
Whatever you prefer, Jim, however you want to do it.
Okay, I'll kind of do it from a high level and you can let me know what I miss. How about that?
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Okay, so again, the idea here in using a Medicaid compliant annuity for non-qualified funds is that would just be that the client has those available assets above those resource allowances, and then the client would purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity. That's going to create that stream of income and remove the resource as accountable asset that was making them not allowing them to get those Medicaid benefits. This works because the Medicaid compliant annuity is written to comply with those Medicaid rules. It's not considered a transfer for less than fair market value, and it's also no longer considered a resource because it falls within all those rules. With a single client, what you'll do with non-qualified funds generally is gift approximately half countable resources, which is going to create that penalty period that we looked at. The client would then use the remaining assets after the gift to purchase the Medicaid compliant annuity, which is structured to match the penalty period to create income so that they can privately pay for the nursing home. And then using their original income and the annuity payments, they privately pay for their care during that penalty period. After the penalty period and the MCA term end, the client becomes eligible for Medicaid benefits. Obviously, the benefit here is you created a gift of the resources to your family or loved one or charity, whoever wanted to receive that. When you're using a community spouse to do this, basically we transfer assets above the community spouse resource allowance over to the community spouse. The community spouse then purchases a Medicaid compliant annuity in their name. They're the owner, the payee. And then they get paid that money back. And the key there is the state is generally in first position as a beneficiary. So you want to make sure that the term of that community spouse's annuity is, you know, something that you expect them to outlive. And generally, the average that we see here at Kraus is between 24 and 36 months for the community spouse allowance. Now, Mark, I'll let you deal with the Medicaid compliant annuity using qualified funds now that we're inside of your specialty here and outside of mine.
So this is the qualified funds. That's write it right in your notes. That means retirement accounts, non-Roth retirement accounts, traditional IRA, are Roth retirement accounts, the Roth IRA. Annuities can be purchased by and owned by retirement accounts. That's 100% permissible, and nobody knows that as well as Kraus Financial Services. And so, you know, you might have a situation, and we're going to kind of have a part two to this presentation, which are some actual case studies, but you might have a situation where a client has non-retirement money, you know, money in checking or savings because they just sold their house, and then they still have some money in a retirement account. Well, in a case like that, it would make the most sense to gift the non-retirement money to the kids and use the retirement money to create a stream of income payable to the client so that we could pay through the penalty period. And so maybe we're going to want to use a traditional IRA, money in a traditional IRA, to purchase a Medicaid compliant IRA inside, or annuity inside, the traditional IRA. So it's really the same thing. It's just got a retirement account wrapper, whether it's traditional IRA or Roth IRA. It's really the owner of that annuity. Is maybe it's not Jane Doe, but it's the Jane Doe IRA. And then the Jane Doe IRA purchases the Medicaid compliant annuity and pays out to Jane Doe accordingly. And so it's really the same thing. It's just, instead of a Jane Doe account, it's a Jane Doe IRA account that's purchasing the annuity. And that may be very beneficial from a planning and tax standpoint. The key thing to realize is that annuities, including Medicaid compliant annuities, can be purchased inside of retirement accounts, traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs. So if you're married, this may be a whole separate, you know, part three or something, but if you're married, you know, if you have a married couple and there are retirement accounts, these are some of the strategies and some of the things to consider talking with Kraus Financial Services about to help your clients, the applicant spouse or the institutionalized spouse and that community spouse who's not applying for benefits. You want to look at, if name on the check rule is perhaps available, spousal support orders, would those work in your state? Can we get a qualified domestic relations order? These things work for pension incomes and for ERISA-based retirement assets, 401ks and 403bs. And then perhaps a legal separation proceeding, which I kind of affectionately tell clients, let's not call it legal separation, even though that's the legal name for it. Let's just call it a financial separation, and let's try to get a court order in a legal separation proceeding that allows us to move retirement account assets. It's really IRA assets. To move IRA assets around on an income tax-free basis. That may be very, very beneficial way to go. So there's certain things we want to look at when we have these larger retirement accounts, including Medicaid-compliant annuities inside these larger retirement accounts. But maybe there's some things we want to do beforehand, before we purchase an asset like that.
Excellent. Yeah. And if any of you have questions about name on the check rule, we do have those resources in Attorney Access as well. So we've done a whole hour on how the name on the check rule works. If you do have a applicant who has a countable retirement account and you have a spouse that might be able to receive the income from that account. And it is very state by state basis, and we do have resources on that. And one of those great resources that actually explains in much more detail exactly about the name on the check rule is the Krauss report. So this is where I would start if you want to learn more about some of these concepts. You can download for free your copy there off our website at krausfinancial.com, the Krauss report. This will have some case studies, and like Mark mentioned, we're going to do a part two. Mark, I think we landed on a June date to do that. So look for that to be announced. We just coordinated dates yesterday, so we don't have that up for registration yet. But what we will be doing on part two is taking some case studies and running some solutions for what to do with some of these retirement accounts. So Mark, if you have a couple of seconds to hang on, we'll take a question here.
Sounds good.
And I don't know if you know the answer to this, but we'll see if you do. In states where the retirement account of the community spouse is exempt, but they're under the age to take minimum distributions, is that retirement account still exempt, even though they're not up to that 73 age at this point?
Yeah. So what I, you know, I've spent a lot of time with these types of accounts. And so age 73, you have to start taking money out. You can't, if it's a traditional retirement account. So mean, or a non-Roth retirement account, you have to start taking money out at age 73 or April 1st of the year after turning age 73. The magical age for accessing the account without a penalty is 59 and a half. So you could take money out of your retirement account without penalty as long as you're age 59 and a half or older. If you're younger than that, then we need to look at an exception to avoid the penalty. And so sometimes, disability is an exception. There's a whole host of exceptions. But anybody, you know, if you have a client who's 63, they can pull out as much money from their retirement account as they want. If it's a traditional non-Roth account, that'll be income for income tax purposes. But you know, a lot of times people will say, I don't need it and I don't want it. So I'm not going to touch my retirement account. I'm just going to let it grow income tax free. When you reach age 73 and you get to April 1st of the year after turning 73, you've now reached a point where you have to start taking money out. If you don't, it's a 50% penalty based on the amount, the minimum amount you're supposed to take out. So it's not, obviously not worth it to avoid, to just keep it in there any longer. I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you everybody for attending. And Mark, I can't thank you enough. Always, I always learn a lot. I took pages of notes. So I always appreciate it, Mark. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you everybody for attending. And if you want to learn more about a lot of the concepts that we talked about, again, we have a lot of great educational resources on our website at krausfinancial.com. Mark, thanks again so much. I really appreciate all your time.
Thank you to Krauss Financial Services, and thanks everyone for attending.
Absolutely. And Mark, I'll see you at the National NALA Conference in Boston. And if any of you are attending, please come bug me and Mark, because it'll make us stop talking about this stuff.
All right. Thanks again, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.